You are listening to the Ivy Podcast. Learn from the thought leaders in areas of strategy, innovation, negotiation, and all things leadership. We interview the Ivy League, Fortune 100, and top startups. Now, here's your host, John Carcy-Baev.
I'm Chris Mihalik. I'm the former CEO of Alight Solutions, which is about a $3 billion player in the human capital technology-enabled service space. Today, I'm actually working with private equity and doing other work with partners to support and advise in the human capital, health technology space, as well as in the professional services space.
Excellent, Chris, and thanks so much for finding time to be with us today. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background? Is human capital and kind of technology, is that your primary expertise that you've been working for the most part, or just curious to get a little bit more flavor into your professional background?
Yeah, for about the last 20 years plus, I've been at three different firms that have consulted or provided technology in the human capital space, predominantly helping large employers as they navigate the complexities of healthcare, their programs for people's retirement, their payroll, et cetera. Been helping with talent in that regard as well. How do you bring in the right talent? How do you keep them and incent them? So those are the kinds of things I've been working on for the last 20 years. In the last 3 years, I was running a company called Alight Solutions, about a $3 billion company, primary focus on benefits administration, running payroll, and doing SaaS deployment in the human capital space.
That's exciting. And I myself do have experience in human capital space. I've spent some time, quite a few years, with one of the major players, Ultima Software, where we've been working on building an onboarding tool for a lot of our clients. So that was a great experience that I went through.
Yeah, they have a great platform, and what they're doing today with their combination with Kronos is pretty exciting. And I noticed their new brand was well featured at the French Open this past weekend.
Right, absolutely. Completely different name with the UKG, right? Our hometown team, Miami Heat, is sponsored by Ultimate Software. Unfortunately, we lost to the Lakers, but that was a great exposure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about innovation in terms of, you know, that's a passion of mine. I've studied that in school, and these days I continue to try to learn from a lot of other executives like yourself. When it comes to building and fostering that culture of innovation within the organizations, can you share with us, I know it's a very broad topic, but any strategies that has helped you in the past when it came to creating such culture of experimentation, and what are some of the most typical kind of pitfalls to avoid as you embark on that journey?
Yeah, I think it's a really important topic. As you may or may not know, Alight was a carve out from a broader organization that was more professional service in its orientation. So a great company that, you know, that did innovation, but in a very different way, mostly on behalf of clients in that regard. But innovation as a technology or from a product perspective was a less core element of the larger parent that we were a part of. When we carved the organization out, one of the first things that, you know, I realized as a leader and our leadership team focused on was how do we create a more innovative environment for a tech-driven capability like the one that we were responsible for? And we recognized it had to be built into the organization from the very core. And so there were a few things over the course of the first couple of years that we did together as a team that I think really drove a greater orientation towards innovation. The first thing we did, we established the values of our firm. And one of our five core values was think forward. We said, you know, it has to be core to who we are. We have to value at the very center of this company, innovation as a core competency. And so we talked about those values a tremendous amount over the first couple of years of establishing the company to let people know that thinking forward, thinking out of the box, on behalf of our company and our clients was a crucial part of who we needed to be. The other thing that we realized is that leaders had to actually lead that revolution, that, you know, we needed our top leadership to actually have their own strengths in terms of building an innovative environment. I remember in the first year that we were established as a standalone independent company, we took our top 100 leaders out of the market for 2 days to specifically focus on building core skill sets around driving a more innovative culture. What are the kinds of things that leaders did in that environment? How did they sponsor and lead things like scrums and so forth that would lead to our innovation around both our technology and our products? And then I think the third thing is you realize you also need some new talent. You got to bring talent into the organization who've experienced that and led that as well. And so we look for new product leaders and we look for new technology leaders predominantly to kind of lead the revolution of what innovation would mean to us. And over that 3 years, you know, we did some incredibly innovative things. We, you know, led the way in terms of artificial intelligence and robotics. We led the way in terms of consumer interface and the kind of technology you put in front of your end consumer. And those things all stemmed out of this desire to be a leader in terms of innovation in our industry sector.
And thanks for sharing that. One of my favorite subjects during my time at Harvard was obviously on innovation. And one of the professors, Professor Stephen Tonkey, he wrote numerous books about innovation and building a culture of experimentation. And one case study that really stood out to me that I still reference to a lot of these days is on booking.com and how they're super famous, you know, as far as building that culture of almost, you know, experimentation, where the developers and, you know, all of the software engineers, they're empowered to deploy code, you know, themselves at any time. And that puts so much accountability on everyone that I think really contributes to that whole factor of creating that culture of innovation that everyone really puts on that hat. So that was pretty exciting.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that point of view more. In fact, you know, I always say that the value of innovation and the, you know, the need for it, some of that messaging comes from the top. But actual innovation actually comes, you know, I'll say from the bottom, but, you know, from the people who are on the ground with clients who are, you know, deeply involved in your technology. And I, you know, I firmly believe if everybody at the top thinks they have to have the best idea all the time, you actually won't build a culture of innovation. You won't have innovation thrive within your organization because it needs to come from lots of different people whose ideas and their contribution is valued in that way. And so, you know, one of the other things that we launched in our first couple of years was a thing we called Spark Tank, which was, you know, our version of, you know, getting people to bring innovation to the table. And we rolled that out to all of our offices around the world. And we said, kind of, best ideas are going to win around here. Let's get them from the field. And we surfaced hundreds of ideas through two rounds of that Spark Tank competition. And I think it really helped us in terms of our product development and getting people's mindset towards, you know, my ideas and my contribution counts around here.
I love that that example. In fact, I'm hosting a executive roundtable towards the end of this month with two executives, and one of them is CTO of SAIC, which is one of the government contractors in IT modernization and digital transformation. And he spoke a lot about building that council, that kind of that Spark Tank that you're talking about, that really allows people to not only compete internally, but allocate, you know, for a company to invest and allow for their resources to work on these projects. I think that's outstanding. Usually that's how a lot of these organizations thrive and come up with some very creative solutions for their clients.
Absolutely.
From your personal standpoint, when it comes to innovation, especially during these current times, with a lot of uncertainty, a lot of these unprecedented, you know, COVID driven news and a lot of companies going through, you know, layoffs and downsizing, unfortunate events. What strategies or even methodologies do you deploy that consistently help you come up with innovative ways to solve particular problems, whether you're working with your client or whether that's in your day-to-day life? Just curious to get your take on what kind of process do you go through?
Yeah, I don't know that I have a, you know, a very specific process around that. I think, you know, from my perspective, when you get into an economic time like this one, you have to make calls about what you focus on, what things you take off your plate in this kind of environment, you know, the things that you fund and care about, and the messages that you deliver to your team. And I think, you know, at this point in time, it's critical that leaders stay focused on the things that will make them successful in the next 6 months as they, you know, work to navigate through where we're at, but also over the next several years as they continue to build the organization of the future. I'm fortunate right now to be involved in the assessment of a handful of different organizations. And one of the things that I really look at is, you know, what do they try to fund in terms of development? And I particularly focus on the technology side of things. What's important to them from a funding perspective? What kind of business case has the IT team and the technology team put forth? And how are those companies funding those forms of innovation to ensure that they keep moving their products forward, keep moving their overall solutions forward, so that they continue to be leaders in the markets that they serve? And I think, you know, it comes down in some ways, yes, it's cultural. Yes, it comes from the field, but it also comes through the way you think about what you fund and what matters to the organization as a whole. So, you know, I think looking at the economics behind innovation is really important for a company to also continue to thrive.
Right, right. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you on that. To switch topics a little bit from your current, you know, experience in the current times, majority of companies being remote and a lot of workers not being so used to working, telecommuting. There's a lot of topics on some things like Zoom fatigue or just not being productive. And good portion of our listeners on Avi Podcast are executives themselves who deal with a lot of these issues as they try to motivate and inspire their staff within their companies. But there's not too much emphasis on that personal aspect of productivity and how do you stay productive as an executive. What helps you in terms of, as an executive, how do you stay productive, you know, during the day? What tools or techniques that help you stay on top of your things, prioritize items? Just curious to get your take on that.
Yeah, and I sort of have the advantage of having stepped out of my CEO role, and, you know, just as COVID was coming in and into a different role. And I think three things are really driving my focus and my ability to, you know, continue to stay on top of work. You know, first and foremost, it's going to sound funny and really tactical, but I'm, as you can tell maybe from the video, I'm at a standing desk. And I find that I'm leaning forward and I'm more engaged when I'm standing up during meetings. I feel more a part of the conversation than when I'm sitting back and listening more. And it's made me, I think, a more active participant in the discussions that I'm a part of. I would say I'm taking more breaks during the day than I did before. I think my schedule prior was, you know, stacked up with calls that, you know, could go from 6 in the morning till 6 at night. And, you know, today I've built in a little bit more time in between those meetings. I've done a number of calls, you know, sitting outside to just be a little bit refreshed while I'm listening and participating. And then I think the last thing that I'm doing that I think is making me better on the calls that I'm a part of is I'm spending more time in preparation. So, oftentimes people don't send me a deck in advance of a call, and I've done a much better job of reaching out, you know, the day before to say, hey, where are the materials? What can I look at in advance? I think that's putting me in a position to be more highly engaged, having done my homework, having a point of view already developed as the call approaches. And I think that's putting me in a better position to be engaged and productive in that regard. I think it'll lead to better decisions. I think it'll lead to, you know, clearer thinking around things. And so those are just a few little things. And I realize they're mostly tactical. That's helping me with my own personal productivity.
Mm-hmm. Right. I love these recommendations. And at the end of the day, it's, as an executive, it's, I mean, you don't ever have to be, you know, it's not a requirement to be in front of camera 24 hours, especially in these times. And I think from what I'm hearing from a lot of executives, it's at the end of the day, it's, yes, these are different times, but putting yourself in the shoes of everyone who is dealing with kids being at home and a lot of those things, I think that empathy and really understanding, you know, balancing the work-life, you know, situation, I think that's very important for executives. So I'm glad to hear some of the examples that you're providing.
Yeah. And John, you know, just maybe as a as more of an afterthought on that, you know, I've noticed a few other things about it, like my reaction time on tough questions is better. My recollection of people's names and, you know, and roles and so forth is much better. My mind is clearer, you know, now that, you know, 12 hours of meeting isn't being driven onto my schedule every day. And I recognize, you know, sometimes that's what's required, but parsing out the time to be more efficient about it and more effective in the meetings that I have has been a great outcome. And it's good. It's great to be able to sit back after, you know, 4 months of scheduling a little different to kind of feel that difference and see that productivity factor come into play.
Right. And I'm sure that was an adjustment as well, but, you know, for the better, really exploring different other, you know, creative avenues in terms of staying productive. So that's very exciting to hear. Obviously, you know, based on your background, you spend a lot of time in, you know, in HCM space and technology. What are the different trends that, or are you observing any specific trends in HCM these days in terms of the industry as a whole or where things are moving towards to? Just curious to get your take on the overall kind of the latest innovations or the trends in this industry.
Yeah, I think, you know, overall, when I think about, you know, the trends, you know, first thing I see is a lot of technology moving into a SaaS environment. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's unique to human capital. I think that's across the board, but you see incredible successes like Ultimate Software and Kronos, like Workday. You see the players who are operating in that SaaS environment. And I think it's changing the way that work gets done. It's making the technologies more flexible to the needs of the employer and how they want to interface with their management and frontline staff. And so I think that whole SaaS ecosystem is really a compelling one. I recently was part of an acquisition. We acquired a company called GlideFast and Faracode. They operate in the ServiceNow ecosystem. And I see just how accelerated the growth is and the opportunity is in that SaaS marketplace. And I do believe that, you know, those software as a service technologies will continue to shape the way work gets done, the way workflows get executed, and how efficient we are. So I think that, you know, that's one trend that I absolutely see. The second one is also technology related, as you might expect. It's machine learning, artificial intelligence. I see those technologies as continuing to shape the way that people make decisions within organizations, the way that individual employees process through applications or workflows. And I think it's enabling companies that are in a service related orientation to do work more efficiently. I know we took at Alight 250 processes, applied robotics process automation to them, essentially took a lot of the human element out of the process. By the way, taking the human element out of the process made the process better in this case. It allowed people to focus on things that mattered more than processing really routine parts of the workflow. Using robotics process automation that operated 24/7 enabled, you know, the individual consumer to get responses faster, more efficiently, with greater accuracy. Those kinds of technologies, I think, will continue to evolve and make us better. I'm working, you know, with a couple of situations that are in the health navigation space. Using data to help individuals make better decisions about their healthcare mm-hmm. is really important. I think because, you know, we want things to be more evidence-driven as we guide people around the decisions we make, we need massive amounts of data about what truly is the best doctor, the best procedure, the best next step. Those things are really important, and artificial intelligence and robotics, I think, is really shaping the way that work gets done in many respects. So those are a couple of things that I'm seeing, particularly from a tech-enabled CEO perspective, that I think continue to shape the world that we're in, the technologies that we use, and the way that we actually serve our clients.
Yeah, very interesting. A lot of the trends, you know, definitely as we talk about advanced technologies, you know, machine learning, AI, those are definitely, you know, the buzzwords these days. But, you know, when it comes to actual implementation or leveraging of such technologies, it's a completely different story. What's your take on companies embarking on that journey as they talk about this digital transformation and really trying to leverage these advanced technologies within that environment? What would be your recommendation, I guess, for other executives as they try to, you know, leverage and take advantage of, you know, AI, machine learning, RPA?
Yeah, well, first, as a leader, you know, I think the first thing is you have to get educated. You have to get up to speed. You have to spend time with experts to really understand how these technologies can be utilized and how they can shape your organization. So, you know, that's one of the first things, that I did in my role was get clear about artificial intelligence, robotics, machine learning, et cetera, to better understand how they could apply. But obviously, my responsibility is to direct the overall organization. You need some real experts, deep experts, to go actually execute on those theories and those concepts. I think every organization should have somebody who's a chief technology officer or a chief innovation officer who's working on applying those kinds of forward-looking technologies into their existing platforms. In some organizations, their platforms are built in a SaaS sort of way, and the application of artificial intelligence could be relatively simple. In other organizations, they have legacy technologies, and using more modern capabilities like machine learning can be a bit more challenging as you're pulling information out of legacy databases. Understanding those unique challenges, I think, is really critical. The last thing I'll say about this one is, you don't have to feel like you have to do it all on your own. We actually embarked on a partnership with Wipro, who's one of the largest global technology companies. And in that relationship, we said, we're going to leverage the depth of expertise that they have around robotics process automation and artificial intelligence. We're going to bring that capability into our shop in what looks like sort of like a joint venture. It's not exactly a joint venture, but what looks like that. And we think we learned from them. We also teach them, and we together got better in terms of these areas. We accelerated the work we were doing. They were making investments that, you know, we didn't have to make. And that I think, pushed us forward in this space as much as anything we did. So I think looking to partnerships and other sources of advancing that agenda, I think, is also important.
Right, absolutely. And it's almost, you know, as simple as that sounds, it's a lot of that is on that preliminary prep work that needs to be done in terms of really defining the core objective of why are we even trying to do this, and surrounding yourself with the right partners. I think definitely it's a sound advice. So thank you for that. Shifting gears a little bit, I want to talk about hiring and interviewing and attracting the top talent. Obviously, as an executive, I'm sure it's one of the continuous top priorities for you and any other executive that I know, to be always on the lookout for the best people. Tell me a little bit more about your approach to that, more specifically around when you interview people, what do you look for in their responses? And, you know, how do you go about facilitating the interviews?
Yeah, and I don't really have an incredibly creative approach to interviewing people. I've always believed that understanding what somebody did in the past is your best way to predict what they're going to do in the future. So I continue to try to better understand, you know, what are the projects you've worked on? What were the successes? How did you work with the people around it? What were the outcomes? So I tend to focus a lot on what people have accomplished and how they accomplished it, as much as anything else. And so that starts to paint a picture of what I'm likely to experience as they come over into my space. Now, I think interviews are effective. I think having multiple people involved in those interviews also helps you to be in a better position. But I've also found using outside sources and, you know, doing referrals and being really diligent about those referrals is really important. And if I had to take a lesson from, you know, the 3 years of leading Alight, you know, one of the lessons I would take is be more patient about the recruiting process. Be more patient about filling the role. Anybody who's tried to fill a more senior level role, they know that they're facing pressures from their board, their management, you know, their people to get a role filled, you know, to make sure the org chart is running correctly and well. And that pressure can really build up and cause you to say, hey, this person hits, you know, checks all the boxes, but isn't necessarily great. And I think one of my lessons learned is, hey, it's worth spending the extra time to go for the person who's absolutely great, that you feel absolutely enthusiastic about how they fit in the culture, what they've done in the past, how they'll contribute in the future, how they'll lead within the organization. I think all of those things are crucial. And rather than compromising, I would, you know, in hindsight, take more time to make sure I got the absolute right person that I'm, you know, that I think is great. And, you know, by the way, I hired some great people, unbelievably great people that made the organization better. So it's not a statement about anybody I hired, but I feel like, you know, looking back, I'd be more patient about that recruiting process than I was in the past.
Right. And absolutely. I love those recommendations. And along those lines, it's something that I've heard recently from one of the executives is, hiring for strength rather than hiring for lack of weakness. Because I noticed that through my line of work, as we help a lot of executives and other organizations with their staffing needs, it's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, interviews and case studies where it's mostly focused on that lack of weakness and can I get along with that type of person versus really understanding what type of skill set are we missing on our team and what kind of strengths would make our team a lot better. So those are just some of my key takeaways as, you know, we talk about this particular topic.
Yeah, John, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, you get to a point where you say, can this person do this job well? That's question A. Question B is, will this person make us better as we move forward in the future? And I think those are very different answers. And you could hire somebody that could do the job well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my conviction, you know, more than ever is I need to hire people that will make our organization better, particularly in the most senior roles within a company. They've got to be people who actually 3 years from now, they're continuing to advance the ball. Both in their day-to-day job and as leaders of the organization, you know, more so than what you have today. And so like my mentality around this has really evolved even over the last, you know, year or so.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, absolutely. I love that. I love that recommendation. From your standpoint, if you were to point out any particular skill set, whether that's technical or, you know, a soft skill, the reason I want to ask this question is because the other good portion of our audience, the listeners that we have, are early stage career professionals or first, you know, second year MBAs or recent graduates. And some of the questions that we get for our guests on the podcast are around, if I'm graduating, what type, you know, if you know what you know now when you were starting out, what would be some of the recommendations that you could provide in terms of investing in yourself and developing a particular skill set? What would that be?
Yeah, I mean, when I think, you know, generally about talent, you know, I think one of the first characteristics I look for is somebody who's hungry, you know, somebody who, you know, and that can come in a lot of different forms. For some people, it's, you know, sort of their lean forward mentality. For other people, it's sort of their work hard mentality. But, you know, I'm looking for somebody who, you know, who is hungry to go take on the piece of work that I have, enthusiastic about the organization that I'm a part of, enthusiastic about being a part of that organization. So that kind of hungry is pretty important to me. I'm a believer that organizations only get better when they have, you know, great leadership. And so I'm always looking at leadership capability. Is this the type of person that other people will follow? And I'm from the, you know, the school of servant leadership, where I believe humility has to come with it. So while I love somebody who's hungry and ambitious, And I think those are important characteristics. I also want somebody who can lead and create and nurture a culture where the whole team moves forward together, where, you know, that person can say, hey, we're going to take this mountain, and people will go, you know, will die on the hill for them. So leadership is crucially important to me. And then, you know, people have to have great capability in the core thing that you're hiring them to do, whether it's to be a technology leader or a financial leader or a business leader. They've got to bring, you know, a core set of skills. And as I said earlier, and a track record of having delivered in the past. So the ability to tell your story about the results you've driven and how you got there is really important to me. So those are, you know, skill sets that I would describe is absolutely core to anybody who I want to bring into an organization. So now, if you ask me more about like skill sets that are in short supply, you know, I mentioned earlier being in the SaaS-based environment. You have places or sectors like that where I think, you know, skill sets are in very short supply. And I think for organizations to be successful, they've got to have a great value proposition to bring great talent in. And so I mentioned GlideFast and Faircode, these two ServiceNow elite partners that are implementing the ServiceNow platform for clients all over the US. They have a very unique value proposition. If you are deeply experienced, if you're a deep subject matter expert, if you love that technology, you probably fit in their organization really well. They're not necessarily hiring people who are green, but they're hiring people who've developed a love for it, a depth of expertise in the ServiceNow platform. And if they put you in an environment with a bunch of other people like that, you'll probably thrive and love the feeling of being a part of that. So I think, you know, even in a place like that where the skill sets are in, I think, short supply, they've done a nice job of telling their story and building a value proposition that will still attract the right talent.
Right, absolutely. And yeah, I couldn't agree more with you on that, because maybe in the space kind of information technology and staffing, especially, you know, when we talk about SaaS, when you talk about cloud, those are some of the absolutely, you know, in highest demand skill set these days. Someone who is able to help the organization not only go from, you know, cloud enabled to cloud native. I think those are some of the very hard to find technologies these days. So definitely can relate on a lot of points that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Chris, last but not least, I'm curious, what are you currently reading and what is one book that you always recommend to others and why?
Yeah, the book that I most recently read is a book called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. It's by a guy named John Mark Comer. You know, it wasn't a life changer for me, but it just was a reminder. And I think lots of the best books are actually reminders of things we already know. And it was about, you know, making sure that your day is structured in a way where you can be at your very best. Take some time of quiet. Make sure you focus on the absolute right things. Make sure that you have time for the things that matter outside of work every day. And so it was a really effective book in helping me to get more comfortable with structuring my day in a way that I think I can be the absolute most productive while not feeling like I am just running from one 45-minute call to the next to have somebody share, you know, their 12-slide deck with me so I can make some, you know, important decisions. Now I feel like I'm, you know, not just because of that book, but because of the way that I'm structuring my day, I think I can be a much more effective contributor, decision maker, and advisor because of the way that I'm, you know, spending my time during the course of my workday. So that book is, you know, it's been good and, you know, a healthy reminder of you know, how to structure my day well. The other book that I absolutely love, and I've recommended it to a ton of people, is a book named Scary Close by a guy named Donald Miller. Scary Close is, you know, kind of about getting to know both the internal side of who you are, as well as the external side, and how you actually are coming across or representing yourself, you know, to people as a leader. And I think a lot of people who grew up in, you know, middle class or blue collar homes like I did, you know, you get to the C-suite and you have a little bit of that imposter syndrome feeling like, hey, do I actually belong here? Do I belong at the table with all of these other people? And what I've recognized over the last few years is I absolutely do belong. And many of the people who are there are feeling the same way at times. And so it's about owning sort of who you are internally so that you actually represent yourself best externally. And I, that book for me was a bit of a game changer in terms of my own personal leadership and the way that I show up every day.
That's great. Love those recommendations. Definitely took notes. And for our listeners, we'll make those titles available in the episode notes. Definitely look forward to checking those books out. Chris, thank you so much for your time today. This was, I love this. This was a very fast-paced, information-packed, although it was a short conversation, but I learned quite a bit. So I really appreciate you lending your expertise with the rest of us today.
Not a problem, John. It's great talking with you, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.